You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Mark Kleiman.
Hello, Glenn Lowry.
Indeed, I am Glenn Lowry at Brown University and the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, and I'm talking with Mark Kleiman, who's a professor of public policy at New York University and an old friend of mine, colleague from Kennedy School days going back 35 years, Mark.
It's true.
And we are here today, and we were just talking about this. I'm not exactly sure why we're here today. It has to do with Donald Trump, of course, and with Mark and I being old friends and Facebook friends and correspondents and colleagues. We run into each other at conferences from time to time. We chat. Having had one or another dispute, I have found myself in the position of objecting to what I thought were smears or scurrilous attacks on the Republican nominee. Not that I'm supporting him, but that I didn't quite like the way in which people tried to peremptorily, dismiss his candidacy and reduce the whole debate of this election down to a assessment of his personality or his purported unfitness to serve in office and so forth. And as a Black American in particular, I objected to people's dismissive responses to Trump's entreaties to his African American friends to vote for him. He's going to fix the problems of the inner cities and so forth and so on. Mark and I found ourselves on opposite sides of some of those debates, and we thought it might be useful to have a Blogging Heads conversation about it. Not to put words in your mouth, Mark, but that's kind of how I'm seeing it.
No, that seems right. That seems right. I'm happy to stand up for the proposition that nobody should consider voting for Donald Trump, and that it's probably even less plausible that African Americans should consider voting for Donald Trump. And last night only reinforced that. Did you have the stomach to watch last night?
Of course, I watched the debate last night. This is debate number two, town hall meeting. Moderated by Martha Raddatz and the CNN guy,
Anderson Cooper.
Vicious back and forth slugfest between the two candidates that got very personal. Of course, this coming just after the release of the video on which Donald Trump is heard making horrific, very disgusting kinds of sexist comments about women whom he'd like to have sex with, or whom behavior in his position as a television star that allows him to touch women without having to get their permission first, and all of that. And also after the WikiLeaks dump of some hacked email and other correspondence of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and so on. So, yeah, I watched the debate.
So what did you take away as the high point? I mean, if you're a historian 50 years from now writing about this debate, what's the one sentence you'd want to capture?
Trump.
I think that's a trick question. I think it's an easy question.
Oh, okay. So I'm probably not going to get it right because I was about to say something like Trump, who goes into this thing with Republicans fleeing his campaign, senators announcing that they wouldn't support him. The humiliation of the public release of this offensive tape that he's where he's caught making these statements. He acquits himself pretty well in the debate. And it looks like his candidacy is still somehow, even if an underdog status, it's still alive. He did what he kind of needed to do in that debate, I thought. But it was awful. I mean, him countering the obvious critique, look how you think about women, look how you treat them, with a reference to Hillary Clinton's husband's behavior in office 20 years ago. He actually had some of these women who have accused President Clinton of inappropriate behavior in the audience. He'd had a little teleconference with them sitting at a table before this thing went down. I mean, how scurrilous can you get? He threatened, should he be elected, that he would actually mount an effort to prosecute his political opponent should she lose the election, in the aftermath of his disappointment that the Justice Department and the FBI didn't come down harder on Secretary Clinton because of her mishandling of emails and so forth. Yeah.
This is the moment where the duck comes down and gives you $100. I think you're restoring
that's
50 years
be a
from
Groucho
now.
Marx reference, but I don't quite get it.
In every show, there was a magic word, and if you said the word, the duck came down and gave you $100.
Okay, and what was the word?
The word was a presidential candidate on a national debate stage threatening to put his opponent in jail like this was some third world country. That's scary, Glenn.
Yeah.
And what's astonishing about Trump is it's not obviously the scariest thing. Look, he is really, in Pat Moynihan's phrase, defined deviancy down. And I think the damage is probably long-lasting, and it will be
to the climate for political discourse in the United States.
Political and moral discourse. I mean, he's just really. And here's one way to phrase this: Voltaire said that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue.
Right.
When that tribute is withheld, beware. And euphemism and politically correct language are, as lots of people point out, forms of hypocrisy. It's very scary when people think they can get away without that. Because reporters are reporters, they want to say it's symmetric, right? It was a very nasty debate last night. The candidates went at each other. And I actually think that's not fair. I don't think this is a symmetric situation. I think it's an asymmetric situation. And journalists and social scientists actually are alike in desperately seeking symmetry.
Okay, there's no way to respond to you without actually giving something of a Trump line here, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. No, they're not equivalent. Trump is accused of being a cad, a boor, an ass. Clinton is accused of breaking the law, of being the beneficiary of a less than forthright and full-throated investigation and prosecutorial process by the Democratic Department of Justice, she's accused of exposing through her careless behavior the secrets and so on of the United States to potential prying eyes from abroad because of her disregard. She's accused of having lied and orchestrated a cover-up of these events and so forth and so on. No, they're not equivalent. They're certainly not equivalent. And the actions that she's accused of are of a graver concern, should they have been validly demonstrated, to the welfare of the country than the personal distasteful characteristics or remarks of her opponent. No, they're not equivalent.
So a couple levels. I was talking about the discourse, not about the substance of the accusations.
Okay.
But with respect to the substance of the accusations, and part of the Trump move is to say it was just words. Well, he wasn't talking about things he'd like to do. Talking about things that he was saying, he habitually did. And we have at least one person now suing him, claiming he did exactly that to her. In fact, more than one. So there's a woman who claims that she was one of the underage girls that Jeffrey Epstein was procuring for his friends, and that Trump was one of the consumers of that. I don't know if it's true or not. But if we're just talking about accusations.
Jeffrey Epstein's friends include Bill Clinton, don't they?
They do. They do. Nobody's.
And you know, defining deviancy down is now sort of like become ubiquitous, right? We're all down in the gutter, right?
But I want to back up.
Right.
To the accusation that the quote Democratic-led Department of Justice fixed the investigation. I mean, look, that's good enough for the pros, Glenn. But you and I know what the relationship is of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to the Department of Justice. We know that the FBI director serves a 10-year term, does not serve at the pleasure of the Attorney General. This particular FBI director happens to be a conservative Republican who was part of the Whitewater crew. I mean, there's no plausible way that you can say that James Comey fixed something for Hillary Clinton. And I think it's pretty shocking that in the course of this, the Republicans have been prepared to weaken the confidence of the country in the FBI on that regard. Now, look, in lots of other regards, I'd love to weaken the confidence of the country in the FBI.
You want to talk about the immunity grants and about all these other things? I'm not on all the details of the investigation.
Remember, I was there. I was in the criminal division for 4 years. I know how this stuff works. It's absolutely automatic. You're investigating something. You got a bunch of people who might have some vulnerability, whose conduct you're not interested in. This is not a grand jury, right? People talk to the FBI of their own volition. Right? The FBI has no power to compel testimony. So if you want somebody to talk to you,
you agree not to look beyond a certain date in January of 2015 at what might be on their computers and to destroy the computers afterwards?
If you're not interested in them, you make the deal you need to make to get them to talk. I mean, the target, if there was a target, was Hillary Clinton.
Nobody has been prosecuted for anything here, so these agreements sacrifice the ability to learn about wrongdoing on behalf of what? I don't see the fruit of the constraint.
Back up, Clint. The Bureau was ordered to investigate whether crimes had been committed in connection with the operation of that private server. Right, that was their charge. They did that. In order to do that, they immunized the people they didn't immunize, who under immunity had no right to do anything but tell them exactly the truth, and who did risk prison if they told them anything but exactly the truth. And that's what you do when you're going after the top person, right? The person they were going after was Hillary Clinton, and James Comey said in a memo to his troops, no reasonable person could have gone forward with that case. And the fact that that's now not good enough, that an exoneration after a full investigation by the Republican director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation is somehow questionable on the basis of the fact that we know that Hillary is guilty and therefore it must have been a fix, is something that no one should have said.
We've watched people go up and take the Fifth Amendment.
Yes.
We've seen thousands of emails destroyed after they had been subpoenaed by the Congress.
There's a substantial distortion in the way that story was told. But
the idea that Secretary Clinton has benefited from a legal dispensation that wouldn't have been available to anyone who was not as powerful and well-connected as she, who didn't have a husband who had been president of the United States, meeting privately with the Attorney General of the United States, in effect, just moments before this decision was been rendered. The idea that I don't entirely trust that process doesn't make me somebody who's trashing the Treasury institutions. The lack of confidence in that process is entirely reasonable, it seems to me, on the facts, Mark.
And if you imagine that the director of the FBI reports to the Attorney General in anything but name, that was not Loretta Lynch's call. That was James Comey's call. And if the whole thing had been fixed for political purposes, then why did Comey do what he should absolutely not have done as the director of the FBI, which is having exonerated a private citizen of any wrongdoing, go on TV in the middle of a political campaign and criticize your behavior? That has never been done in the history of the Bureau. If they don't charge somebody, they don't slander somebody. No,
Are you criticizing Comey now?
I am absolutely criticizing Comey for the decision not to prosecute, which I believe him when he says to his own troops there was no way to make the call the other way. But having made that call, instead of doing what he's always done, which is say we close the investigation without charges, he decided to go on TV and criticize the Democratic candidate for president of the United States.
And why do you think he did that?
Huh?
Did he not? Is it not at least plausible that he thought that was his duty to do on behalf of the country? Because he thought a simple, straightforward exoneration on the legal charges would not adequately serve the public's need to know about the unwise and unprofessional behavior of the target of that investigation. But who's running for president?
Huh? Sorry.
I said maybe he felt a duty to tell the people what he knew and what he thought about what was going on, because the person whom he was not prepared to recommend a criminal charge against nevertheless had behaved in ways that cast doubt upon her fitness to be president. Maybe that's why he did it.
It is not the job of law enforcement to vet political candidates. It's the job of law enforcement to decide whether the law was broken, whether a prosecutor case exists. You precisely do not want the FBI director deciding who's fit to be president. That's not the way we do it in this country.
Okay. Okay, I take the point. Let's move on and talk about something else. I mean, something else within the same ambit of what it is that we're talking about here now.
So the question that actually sort of got us into this was, let me quote you and see if I'm quoting you accurately. African Americans have been on the Democratic plantation for too long because they're loyal Democratic voters. They're not at the margin. Therefore, Democrats don't have to actually do anything to get their votes. They're treated the way the right-to-lifers are mostly treated by the Republicans. They're useful at election time, and then their needs are to be ignored. And the way to fix that problem is for – oh, and in fact, a number of the policies pursued by Democrats are not actually very helpful to African Americans. And the way to fix that problem is for African Americans to become less loyal and therefore be in a better bargaining position within the Democratic coalition. Is that – pretty much correct?
So far, so good. It's not complete, but it's accurate as far as...
Okay, so what's incomplete? What are they about?
I've got a half century since the Great Society of basic democratic control of the relevant political institutions affecting this population. And I've got a stagnation and a persistence of the socially disadvantaged conditions of African Americans. I've got schools that don't work. I've got communities that are not safe. I've got people without jobs. And I've got an opportunity to either go along with business as usual by endorsing a candidate and a party that actually haven't said anything new or interesting about this problem in a quarter century, or to shake things up by looking around for some alternatives and at least giving a listen to somebody who comes and speaks about these problems in a different register. So that what I'm against here, and I'll take the point that Donald Trump may not be an appropriate vehicle for the expression of this dissatisfaction with the Democrats, but what I'm against here is a dismissal of even having a conversation about the inadequacy of the incumbent political arrangements to serve the needs of this community. I'm against dismissing an argument about public safety where on one hand I have Black Lives Matter and on the other hand I have Blue Lives Matter by calling somebody a racist if they don't genuflect to the Black Lives Matter line. I object to dismissing a discussion about reform of education in the cities by acting as if the National Education Association actually was the best friend that the black school kids ever had, when it seems to me that that's demonstrably not the case and that shaking things up in the delivery of educational services would be a good thing. And so on. I'm against the idea that, we don't need to try to incentivize businesses to come in and provide jobs for people in inner cities, or we don't need to talk about ways in which we're going to get these people jobs. We simply need to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and that'll take care of everything, so forth and so on.
Okay, so let me do those one at a time. So there's a first question, it seems to me, which is that ignoring what race you are, who would you like to be president, right? So the presidential choice behind the veil of ignorance. And then there's a question about, okay, but who should my group support? Needn't be the same answer, but it seems to me the first answer is certainly relevant to the second one.
Can I just ask why it is that I would want to make a presidential choice behind the veil of ignorance? I'm not a philosopher designing the theory of a perfect society. I'm a self-interested voter who has interests.
But not only self-interested. I mean, presumably other Americans' fates are also of interest to you.
Of course.
And if that's right, then it makes sense to ask, well, turning off the race variable for the moment, right, who's the better president for the country? in particular, he's the better president for African Americans or Jews or Catholics or evangelicals is not the better president for the country, then they have to make a decision about whether it's actually better for them to go with something that's worse for the country, because other people are likely to notice that.
Okay.
Right?
But so, we're going to say the same for Hispanics, for women.
Yeah, exactly.
For all the other elements of the various coalitions. Right. Let's think about the country and not just about our own group. Okay.
Right. I mean, I have no tolerance for people who tell me how I should vote as a Jew.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, screw that.
Okay.
Except this year. when I say that, you know, any Jew who votes for a guy who pals around with open anti-Semites ought to have his head examined. I think there's a better case for defensive group voting than for merely interest-seeking group voting. But now let's talk about the two cases you brought up, public safety and education.
Yeah.
Right? So Trump is critiquing the status quo with respect to both of those. Now, the first thing to say about the status quo with respect to public safety is it has spectacularly improved.
Yeah.
Hopefully since Bill Clinton got elected president. Now, that's got to be accident, but that's about the time period.
Yeah, we're all aware of the dramatic drop in crime since the early 1990s, although there has been an uptick in recent years.
Depends on who you mean by we. Donald Trump has never acknowledged that spectacular public accomplishment. Okay. All he's talked about is the uptick of the last year.
Well, right? he has talked about the uptick of the last year. With dead cops laying around in Dallas, and with mobs in the streets of Ferguson and Baltimore and Charlotte, and other such places, and with a lot of people, including the Democratic National Committee, celebrating the movement that markets itself as being acting on behalf of the preservation of black life, but that could be deeply criticized on many grounds, and I've done it here at Blogging Heads before. There's nothing wrong in my mind with a little bit of counterpoint to that.
Well, but it would be helpful if you mentioned that there are dead cops in the street, that there have been fewer dead cops in the street every year of the Obama administration than the year before.
I didn't know that as a matter of fact. Although, you know, okay. I'm not sure.
But that's my point, that the Donald Trump, Heather McDonald discourse ignores a lot of facts. And look, this is what this is stuff I do for a living.
Which is why I'm deferring to you on this, Mark.
Right.
Although a lot of smart people. Let me just ask you a question. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Okay.
So you're in New York City. You're there in New York City, and crime has dropped in New York City. And in the period when Bill Clinton was president, there were, what, something like 2,000 people a year being homicide victims in New York. And in the most recent year, there's, what, under 400 people as homicide victims in New York. So crime is down across the board, and crime is down in New York City. Do you think that the activities of the New York City police with respect to trying to engage in the Ray Kelly
stop,
call it?
Stop and frisk.
Stop and frisk. Yeah, proactive policing was the phrase. Have anything to do with that decline in crime? And do you think that seeing the police as your enemy, if your interest is the preservation of black lives, is a particularly productive way of approaching that problem?
No. As you know, I completely share your critique of Black Lives Matter. I actually think that Clinton has been very careful to acknowledge their concerns without endorsing the nonsense. I've been pretty pleased with that. There's no doubt that proactive policing made a contribution. There's also no doubt that it went way too far. I mean, look, you were on the receiving end of that, you told me the story.
I was.
Let me just say
to the viewers who might not know, when I lived in New York, 2010, 2011, as a visiting professor at Columbia, I was stopped on my bicycle 100 feet from my front door for riding my bicycle on the sidewalk and given a citation requiring me to appear in court by two, as it happens, female police officers who seem to have nothing better to do than to rouse the 60-something academic just trying to get up the hill to his office, require me to appear in court for riding my bicycle on the sidewalk? That's an outrage. So I just want people to know, right on, Mark Kleinman, I chafed mightily at the overreach of the constabulary of New York City and just messing with me because I was riding my bicycle. Okay, so point taken.
All right. So now subtract 50 years and 15 years of formal education and imagine what that experience is like every day. And you probably weren't living in, you were not living in an especially high-crime neighborhood.
It had been a high-crime neighborhood at one time, but it was gentrifying just north of Central Park on 6th Avenue.
Right. You know, if you'd been living in East New York, it would have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, both in terms of crime and in terms of aggressiveness. Right. So the NYPD got aggressive. They took it too far. Not under Bill de Blasio and Bill Bratton, but while Michael Bloomberg was still mayor and Ray Kelly was still police chief, they finally said, okay, guys, we got to back off. Radically cut back on stop question frisk. Cut back about 95%. There was about a six-month increase in shootings. Not obviously causal, but it was right after the change. The department adjusted its processes. Homicides are back down this year. Shootings are not up. So we lost 95% of the stop, question, and frisks. And as far as we can tell, 0% of the efficacy. Right? Suggests that there was a fair amount of overshoot. And if you concentrated your stop, question, and frisk on the people actually likely to be carrying guns, you could continue to have the benefit you wanted without pissing off the entire community. And as everybody in the policing business knows, crimes are not solved by the police. Crimes are solved by the community members who watch the event talking about it. And so police-community relations, which sounds like, you know, liberal, you know, kumbaya nonsense, is the center of effective policing in high-crime neighborhoods. And the police managers I know, and people like David Kennedy, who you know David.
I do know David.
At the National Network. So they have very little tolerance for Black Lives Matter. But they have even less tolerance for Donald Trump announcing that he's going to stop and frisk everybody and bring the crime rate under control.
Okay,
he's simply not being at all intellectually or morally serious about the actual management problem. Because after all, he's never actually managed anything.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand this. Okay. Let me set that aside for a moment. I'm not going to defend Trump here, but I want to make sure I understand what you're saying about stop and frisk. You think it did make a positive contribution, but it was taken too far. You think that the fact that after people backed off, the murders didn't go up dramatically tells us that it wasn't contributing, that is, the stop, question, and frisk policy wasn't contributing so much to the decline that that we were just talking about? And you are against the embrace of this policy in other cities? For the reason that it alienates communities and we need their involvement to be able to solve crimes?
Right. Again, stop, question, frisk is like blood pressure medicine. Right? It's not a thing you do automatically to everybody. It's a thing you do at the right place at the right time. Is it a valuable tool? Absolutely. And Bratton has never backed off from its use as a valuable tool. Can it be way overdone? Yes, it can be way overdone. NYPD did a lot of things other than aggressive policing that helped bring the crime rate down. Most important was focusing the entire department on bringing the crime rate down and holding subunits accountable for crime results. But it also did lots of useful things about police-community relations. If you look at Chicago...
Yeah, I was going to go there.
Their problem is not that their cops are insufficiently aggressive. The problem is that Chicago is two generations behind New York in police management. It's still in the old corrupt mode. And, you know, the shocking thing about Chicago was there was that case where the guy was shot 16 times, you know, cop rolls up,
Laquan McDonald. Dude, his name was Laquan right. McDonald.
And look, am I shocked that a police officer under pressure did the wrong thing? No. You know, regrettably, that stuff happens.
The cover-up after.
You should ask how you
I'm sorry.
The cover-up after.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the fact that everybody in the cover-up got away with it.
Yeah.
And that it was universal, that none of the 16 officers on the scene told the truth. That's a radically sick department. And I have to say, much as you and I both dislike the excesses of Black Lives Matter, they put the issue on the table. I do not at all believe that police misconduct or police cover-up is worse now than it was 10 years ago. It's probably better. But it's been brought to the surface.
When your candidate... I'm sorry. Go ahead. I want to let you finish. I have another question when you're done.
So are there practical things to do about both police misconduct and crime that are actually being done by the kind of people that Hillary Clinton listens to? And the Trump campaign makes no contact with any of that. They're just going back to 1968 rhetoric. In the meantime, they're also supporting a pervasive right to carry open and concealed. Right? Now, the whole point of Stop Questioning Frisk is to get somebody with a gun.
Yeah.
So, on this as in everything else, I take him as non-serious.
Let me back up for
a minute.
You want to go to something else, and I want you to go to something else, but I want to ask you something first.
Oh.
During the vice presidential debate of Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, Kaine said a couple of things that I don't think are true. He said that stop and frisk had been found unconstitutional. I don't believe that's true. I know that a lower court judge did issue an opinion, but I also think that that was not affirmed by higher courts, and that judge was actually removed from the case because of judgments that she had been biased in that case. He said that it was a fact that blacks and Latinos get sentenced to longer terms in prison for committing the same crimes, and that was a part of the issue of racial disparity and incarceration. I don't believe that's true, Mark. I mean, that's not at all my impression of the literature, particularly if you control for the criminal records of people who are being sentenced when you make that assessment. And there was another thing. It is, it may come back to me. Oh, Mark.
Pardon me.
Sorry.
All right, I warned you that when you said something smart for me, I would go into conflict
then, sir. He said something else that I was uncertain about true, but I've now forgotten what it is. So anyway, go ahead and respond to what I was just saying.
Okay, so there was a judgment that the Stop Question Frisk was unconstitutional, and the department didn't appeal. So to say it wasn't upheld is a little strange. The ruling was it was unconstitutional.
What you mean when the Democrat got elected mayor, he didn't carry the case back to find out whether or not a higher court was going to rebuke because he liked the ruling that the lower court had found?
Well, because his lawyers told him he couldn't win, I don't know which. My lawyer friends tell me that was sound law. As to sentencing disparities, my understanding of the literature is that black defendants don't trust their lawyers and as a result make bad decisions that lead them to spend more time in prison. It's not at all clear that there are other parts of the system that work, though there's this very unfortunate recent finding about football games. Did you see that one?
No, I didn't.
So you look at states that have state universities,
yeah,
that have football teams.
Yeah.
You look at judges who went to those state universities, and you look at their judgments the Monday morning after their team lost, and they sentence black defendants much more harshly.
The causality being that they're pissed off at the football players, most of whom are black, and they take it out on the defendants that are being sentenced in their courtroom?
No, I think the causality is that they're merely pissed off and they're less well self-controlled than they ought to be. Look, I think it would be strange to deny that there's bias in the system. I think it'd be very strange to deny there's bias in the shootings. And look, you wrote the paper on this, though, not about policing. There can be lots of structural bias without anybody harboring racial ill will.
Sure.
Right? If people have statistical patterns about who's going to be dangerous, and you and I know those patterns are valid, then cops are going to shoot more black people than white people. In fact, I'm surprised when I look at the data and how narrow the disparity is.
The disparity isn't bigger than,
But it is clear that race does play a role here. It's clear that there are things we could do about it, that implicit bias is one of the things we need to address.
How will we
Mike Pence was
now,
shocked
I'm
to hear that there's implicit bias in the world.
I'm puzzled by what seems to me to be a blatant contradiction. Implicit bias, on my understanding of the social psychological theory, is a reference to the tendency that all of us harbor to incorporate into our assessments of individuals certain atmospheric or background connotations, stereotypes, and judgments about particular kinds of people, like people who are black or people who are women or whatever. We find the bias even being manifested in African Americans in these tests. So the contradiction, it seems to me, is that given that we are talking here about a deeply entrenched cognitive affect, a phenomenon about behavior that's not subject to control and that is harbored by people, even those belonging to the disadvantaged groups, what exactly is the intervention that we're going to undertake that's going to root this out? How will we train police differently so that they wouldn't be harboring this implicit bias, which is so deeply rooted that even someone like me may be harboring it to the disadvantage of African Americans?
You can't get rid of implicit bias.
Okay.
You can make people self-aware about it and train them to behave in a way that represses it. Right? That's what professional training is about. And I think there's a serious critique of the way we recruit and train police officers that leads us to get an unnecessary number of violent incidents. So if you look at the U.S. and Germany, for example, Germany has about the U.S. has about six times as many homicides per capita as Germany. The U.S. has about 40 times as many police civilian killings as Germany. Right? German police officers killed 9 people last year. It's partly because we train our officers to fear. It's partly because we recruit young men, preferentially combat veterans. It's partly because we put them through something that looks like Marine boot camp. Right. So there are lots of ways you could.
Yeah. No. My guess is all those things. All those things that you mentioned are more important than the purported bias that these police. Everything you said has nothing to do with race. It has to do with the protocols that govern police use of force, and the methods of training that accustom police to react in dangerous situations in a particularly aggressive way.
Right. And so, if you want to get down the number of police shootings of black men.
No, I want to get the number down. Hold on. I want to get the number down for everybody. They're twice as many white as black who are killed in any given year by the police. I want the number to come down, not because those victims are black. That seems to me to be a red herring. Pardon the confused pun.
I completely agree with you. So this is the discussion about police reform we ought to be having.
Okay.
And it's a discussion I can imagine having with Secretary Clinton and the people who work for her, and it's a discussion I can't imagine having with Donald Trump. That's the sense in which I think that Trump is just unfit to be president. He doesn't want to think about any of this stuff.
I don't understand this, Mark. You wouldn't have this discussion with Rudy Giuliani? Of course you wouldn't have the discussion with Trump. You'd have it with somebody like Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie. They can't talk about police training either? What makes you confident in saying that?
Because I've heard them. I mean, first off, neither of them has any direct experience with local policing. They're both prosecutors, both federal prosecutors. And remember, Rudy hired Bill Bratton. That's his claim to fame.
It was a good hire. It was a good hire, Mark.
Huh?
I said it was a good hire.
It was a good hire. He fired him 18 months later.
Well, he's Rudy.
He's Rudy.
Bratton was taking too much of the limelight. Isn't that the issue?
But all I'm saying is that Rudy, like Trump, like Christie, knows what he thinks, and that's the truth, and don't confuse him with the facts. I actually worked for Rudy at one point, so this is personal for me. No,
okay, so I don't know. I don't know what Giuliani's position.
I want to go back to the public education side. Because I think there's an important disconnect here.
Okay.
Right. So on the one hand, there's a critique of policing, and Black Lives Matter is saying rude things about cops, and Trump is defending cops. And proud of the fact that the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the most reactionary of the police unions, has endorsed him. One of the bad things about policing is that police unions and other organizations have managed to create what's called a police officer's bill of rights, which basically makes it very hard to discipline police officers for misconduct. Okay, hold that thought for a second. By the way, despite all of that, we massively reformed and improved American policing. There's less misconduct and there's less crime. And we didn't do that by denigrating police officers. Everybody on a debate stage has to verbally worship police officers. That's the rule. Not allowed to criticize police officers. You're allowed to say there's a few bad apples, right? And that's actually a pretty sound instinct, because you can't actually reform an organization by denigrating the people who do the work. Right? If they don't feel good about themselves, they're not going to do good work.
Okay. Bless you, now, Mark. Bless you.
Let's fix the public schools. Public school teachers actually have less protection against being fired for misconduct than police officers do. But that's a big scandal. Public school teachers have unions. Oh, their unions are horrible people. They're the ones who are making our kids not learn. And we ought to fix education by telling everybody that teachers are awful people, and we have to break up their unions and take away their pensions and put them to work for for-profit corporations. Do you see the disconnect? Now, look, like everybody in our generation,
that argument can be run in either direction. That argument can be run in either direction. It can be an argument about being tougher on police unions, not being easier on teachers' unions.
Or both. All I'm saying is, even if you're going to be rough on the unions, you need to be careful not to denigrate the professionals. One of the problems of American teaching is that it's not now a highly respected profession. Right? In Finland, which doesn't pay its teachers particularly well, they get teachers from the top fifth of their university graduating class.
Mark, does the respect that teachers command have nothing to do with what the teachers actually do? Is the respect that teachers command something that can be manipulated independently of who it is that elects to go into teaching in the first place?
No.
When the union tells me that I can't test the teachers in order to find out what they know, and I can't base their compensation on the extent to which they perform effectively, as best I can determine that, in the classroom, are they not, by, in effect, protecting mediocrity, contributing to the low reputation of this profession?
And if I were advising teachers' unions, I would say all of that. And in fact, there's a substantial faction within the teachers' union movement that believes more or less that. My formula for this is that we need a Flexner Commission for education. Right, so American medicine was not a high-status profession before 1915. And then you made it very, very, very hard to get an MD. And their incomes actually didn't go up until Medicare, but their social status went way up. I think we do need to do that to teaching, and I'm perfectly happy to get into that discussion. Having looked at the literature on charter schools, right? And again, like everybody in our generation, I wanted to run one. Public schools were terrible. It had to be easy to do better than that. in real life, it turns out to be hard to do better than that, and a lot of the apparent advantages of charter schools are mere sample selection bias. Right? They have the advantage that if a kid doesn't do well in the charter school, you can kick him right back out into the public school.
I would commend to your attention Roland Fryer's article in the Quarterly Journal of Economics of 3 or 4 years ago on the extensive field experiment work that he did in Houston, where in a random assignment setting, he and his team took over a dozen or so public schools in Houston and implemented in them, with full control over personnel, principals, teachers, curriculum, and the rest, a replica of the KIPP Academy charter school model in the treatment schools. And he found significant improvement in the academic performance as measured by test of the students randomly assigned to the schools that got the charter package-like treatment. They remained not charter schools, but conventional public schools, but they were experimentally having their curriculum and their personnel modified. So there would be some evidence, I mean, it's not the last word on it by any means, that the methods that we associate with the best charter schools can deliver improved educational outcomes for inner city kids.
Right. I find that very easy to believe. Okay. And that seems to me like something worth spreading. The insistence on the what I call the billionaire school reform movement on breaking the union first as a condition strikes me as counterproductive. I mean, remember, who invented charter schools? Who brought that on the American political stage? Al Shanker. It's an idea that originally came from the American Federation of Teachers. And so I think we need to work with teachers to upgrade the profession. You and I may disagree. I think it's obvious that the current pay structure is not appropriate. One thing you might do for teaching is what the police do, which is give people half their retirement after 20 years as a way of getting rid of people who are no longer happy in the classroom. Right? We know that there is burnout and that teacher performance rises for 5, maybe 10 years, then peaks, and then drops off substantially. Well, that's probably true of patrol officer performance, too, but we don't have to stay that long, and we make it financially attractive for them to get the hell out. So, look, yes, there's policing reform to be done. There's education reform to be done. Some of it's going to require pushing the unions around. But denigrating teachers as a class and smashing their unions doesn't strike me as an especially good way to start. And I want to claim that the experiment has been done. The entire South, most of the Midwest, all of the Mountain West are right-to-work states with Republican, Tea Party governments, right, where the teachers' unions do not control the education system. So where are the Nobel laureates coming out of Kansas?
Easy, Mark. Easy. I take your point, though. Easy.
Well, I mean, if you control for SES and look at state as the variable,
somebody
ought to find that right to work states.
I think we ought to do the study. You convinced me that it would be worth looking at. You don't convince me that the conclusion is such as you declare, but somebody ought to take a look.
Yep. So.
Okay. I want to go back.
Go ahead.
I want to go back to the discussion about the inner cities being basket cases of social dysfunction, and the democratic local, state, and federal suzerainty in political terms hasn't delivered much for those folks. What the hell do you have to lose? What the hell do I have to lose by voting for somebody who promises to come in, break things up, and bring a new cast of mind and a new set of ideas to dealing with these problems? And let me just finish. At least he's talking about it and making promises. We can assess how credible those promises are. At least he's talking about it and making promises to give it his attention. Why isn't that a good thing? From the point of view of African Americans,
It would be a good thing if it were serious. It were a good thing if I could go on his website and see the detailed policy proposals and judge them. It would be a good thing if he hadn't been working for him who knew anything about this. So who's his most distinguished domestic policy advisor?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I have no idea, to be honest with you. I have no idea.
Huh?
I said I have no idea. Certainly, no one like myself who values his reputation or hers would dare to associate with a campaign that has been characterized by everybody in sight as being racist and beyond the pale. So in a way, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, if I thought that he had any chance of winning whatsoever and that I could have a life afterwards, I might be willing to go to a few meetings and, you know, for what it might be worth, share the benefit of my wisdom. Not that I'm endorsing Donald Trump, but that I really care about the problems.
Right.
And should he get elected, he's made a promise I'd love to be able to see him try to deliver on.
Well, so, but it seems to me the fact that your phone hasn't rung is a very loud silence. Right, Amir's one of the most distinguished social scientists in the country, and an African-American, you know, you'd be a second African-American supporter, saying nice things about him. Where's the campaign on the phone to you saying, okay, what ideas do you have for us? You should at least have had to turn them down.
Okay.
No, I think he's profoundly incurious. Has no respect. Look, he thinks he knows more about how to deal with ISIS than the generals. He has complete contempt for expertise. Right? This is much deeper than politics. Though, again, I think it's asymmetric with respect to the parties. Trump is partly what happens when one of the major political parties spends 30 years telling you, don't believe anything a reporter or a professor says. You know, there's no control left. And when they try to say, no, Trump isn't acceptable, nobody's listening to them. They have disabled that whole machinery of qualification.
I think you overstate the role of the Republicans here, but I take your point that that's what they're saying. I would say that the distrust of expertise of professors and of journalists runs much deeper. And in the 35 or 40% of Americans who are going to vote for Donald Trump come what may, they're discussed with Harvard University faculty. What did our mutual friend James Q. Wilson say? That rather be – no, it was Bill Buckley who said this. I think it was only Wilson
who quotes
him.
It was Bill Buckley,
who
was not a friend of mine.
It was Wilson – yeah, no, it was Wilson who quotes him, but – I'd rather be governed by the first 400 names in the telephone book than by the faculty of Harvard University. The distrust of that is something that's very widespread. It's not just a Republican matter. It's a populist revolt. It partly explains Donald Trump's ascendancy, doesn't it? That people don't trust these institutions. They've been alienated.
Well,
the institutions are biased in terms of their outlook, and they do have disdain for the sensibilities of people who think men's and women's bathroom signs really ought to mean something or whatever.
Whatever the causes are, the effect I see is that Democratic administrations are much more likely to take good advice. Remember, Trump's contempt extends to generals, extends to the intelligence community. Nobody knows anything, according to Donald Trump. And, you know, I mean, I think he's partly such a salesman that he thinks it's just a matter of whatever you got somebody into. I was wrong, and I will admit that I was wrong, to criticize George W. Bush as our first postmodern president. Because I hadn't really seen postmodernism in politics until I got to watch Trump. But let's go back to the hegemony problem.
Okay.
So there are two potential problems here as I see it, right? One is that African Americans are asking for things that they can't get because they're such loyal Democrats, Democrats don't have to worry about keeping their votes. The other thing is that the African American political leadership is not asking for the things that you think it ought to be asking for in the interests of the community. And I know how that feels because I see what the professional Jewish leadership asks for, and it's nothing any Jew wants. But if that's going to be fixed, it really can't be fixed at a Democratic Party level. It means you've got to create some local leadership that asks for the right things. But as to who's got power in the Democratic Party,
yeah,
a little bit of recent history. 2008, a solid, not overwhelming, but solid majority of white Democrats wanted Hillary Clinton to be the nominee. And an overwhelming majority of black Democrats, once it looked like he could actually do it, wanted Barack Obama to be the nominee, and guess who got nominated? And now it's 8 years later, and a very solid majority of white Democrats wanted Bernie Sanders. And an overwhelming majority of African Americans wanted Hillary Clinton. And guess who got nominated? African Americans are the 800-pound gorilla of the Democratic coalition. They sleep wherever they want. And now the question is, where they want to sleep? And if you want to take on the task of generating demand within the community for policies that will be more effectively useful, Lord love you. But I would say that a whole set of policies that I would undertake to fix African-American and Latino problems are not specifically race-based. They're much more class-based. Right? So if we partial out the disadvantage of African-Americans to the racial disadvantage and the income and particularly wealth disadvantage, I would put a lot more stress on the latter, and I can fix the latter without ever mentioning race.
We're
I can fix that in the tax system.
But I just want to say for the sake of the record that you and I agree about this, what you're saying right now, which is that most of the problems that the black community faces are
probably but now of the two...
Go ahead.
But of the two political parties, which one is inclined to distribute wealth and power downward? That seems to me like an easy question.
I don't know that it's so easy a question.
Certainly in the tax system it is. Democrats want lower taxes for working people, and Republicans want lower taxes for hedge fund operators.
Yeah.
If you look at the Ryan budget, if you look at the Bush tax cuts, if you look at the Trump tax cuts, they're all the same. 90% of the money goes to the very top of the scale. And Trump wants to get rid of the estate tax altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, there benefits very few African Americans.
Yeah.
And the Obama administration did such something I never believed would happen. They didn't make a lot of noise about it. But they have launched a campaign to get cities to relax their land use planning to allow more housing to be built. Now, that's a direct transfer of wealth from homeowners to everybody else.
Explain that. Explain that. And let this be the last point because we're running long. Explain how it is that changing zoning regulations transfers wealth from homeowners to everybody else.
Right. No, it's not just zoning. It's land use planning more generally.
Okay.
But if you limit the supply of housing in New York City, you drive up the price of housing.
I see.
That benefits owners of existing housing.
Okay, so we're going to expand. We're going to expand the supply of housing and push the price of housing down. But that's being prevented by land use restraints, and the Obama administration had, at least at some point, advocated relaxation of those constraints.
Just now. They're pushing hard.
Okay. I learned something. I'm going to let you have the last word, Mark.
I think that's a good last word to have, except, get out and vote. I mean...
I think the Republic is actually under threat. You think what?
Huh?
Go ahead.
I think the Republic is actually under threat in a very profound way from a candidate who's not merely personally unfit for office, but is leading an extremely dangerous coalition. And I think what the country needs right now is a massive rebuke to this version of the Republican Party.
I think you're dead wrong. I think whatever the merits of this particular candidate, the coalition that he leads is going to be here, and rebuking them is not going to make them go away. They're going to have to be dealt with. Their interest in coal country, their interest in the white males who feel like they're being pushed to the side, their interest in objection to political correctness and all the rest needs to be dealt with, not simply rebuked. This is not a scolding enterprise here. Defeat Donald Trump and consign him to the dustbin of history. you've still got scores of millions of Americans who your candidate characterizes as deplorables who are going to be here and are going to have to be dealt with. I think they have to not be lectured. Lecturing them from the academy, lecturing them because, I don't know, they think men's and women's bathrooms should mean something. They haven't caught, you talk about the postmodern candidate, the postmodern cultural sensibility that looks down its noses from Bill Maher's perch or whatever, at the yahoos who have rallied behind and attend these rabid rallies and all the rest of Donald Trump. The sneering at these people, the smug attitude in response to them is not going to be enough to get us out of the hole that we're in here, I think. I'm sorry, you're supposed to have the last word, so I'll shut up and let you have the last word.
Okay, I think that's right. I think that the politicians on the Republican side were willing to play along with Trump when they thought they could control him. And then didn't have the courage to back away from him when it was obvious that he was really dangerous, need to be reminded that there are consequences. So that's a different audience than the Trump voters. Paul Ryan apparently said this morning that he's no longer going to defend Trump and he's not going to withdraw his endorsement. So I'm hoping that some historian will write a history of the Republican Party in the 2016 campaign, and I've even got a title that I'm prepared to give away for free, Profiles in Cowardice.
I nominate Rick Perlstein to do that.
Rick would be a good person to do it, but I'd rather have it done by a Republican.
Yeah. All right, Mark, thanks for straightening me out on more than one matter. I survived this conversation with my own self-respect intact. I don't know if anybody else respects me, but that's okay.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Glenn.
Take care of yourself and feel better, okay?
I'll do that. Be well.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.